This is Sciographies, an introduction to people who make Canadian science happen.
I'm David Barkley, co-host and an assistant professor in the Department of Oceanography.
I'm Shauna Bullman, co-host, neuroscience student, and science communication intern.
I'm Nicole Comeau, and we're all from Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science. In this episode, we chat with Jordan Kyriakides. He's an associate professor of quantum theory in the Department of Physics and Atmospheric Science and CEO of QRA Corp, a tech startup here in Halifax. QRA was formed after Dr. Kyriakides led a research project here at Dalhousie where he identified a gap in how his industry partner was tackling the early stages of developing complex systems they required to do business. Dr. Kyriakides dove headfirst into co-founding his own company with no prior experience or training in business management. But he tells us being an academic research scientist parallels being a CEO in some ways. He also tells us about his upbringing as the child of Greek immigrants in Toronto, the difference between theoretical and experimental physics, and his research interest in quantum computing.
Okay. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in downtown Toronto. So I'm a first-generation immigrant. My parents immigrated a couple years before I was born. My dad was a truck driver, and my mom was at home raising the family and sometimes working at a donut shop.
Right, okay.
So no, they grew up in post-war Greece, so they didn't even have any advanced education at all. They came here to have a better life for their kids.
Yes.
They settled in downtown Toronto. And that's where I was born, went to school, went to high school.
Yeah.
And then I graduated high school. Actually, I didn't graduate. I don't actually have a high school degree, actually. Even today, I don't. But I did get into Waterloo. And when I went to Waterloo for the first couple of years, it was a huge culture shock because I was so sheltered. I was grew up in downtown Toronto, but our high school only had under 1,000 people, which for Toronto is a very small school. And they were all children of immigrants there. Then when I went to Waterloo, it was just, it was like I stepped into another world.
Where Anglo met Saxon.
That's right. This was back in, you know, I'm dating myself, but in the 88 and 87, Waterloo was very different then than it is now.
Right. In high school, were you like a very, was it very clear that you were going to be an academic type student?
No.
So how did you kind of get the idea to go to college?
I got into physics in particular. So when I was looking around what to do after high school, I had two big interests, was music and physics. And music, I always had an interest, kind of musical, family's pretty musical. I assumed that seemed like a cool thing to do. And then my, but I was always smart. I always got mathematics.
Okay.
Like a teacher would describe it, it's like, okay, yeah, I get it. You just need to tell me once it makes sense to me. So I was always inclined towards math and science. Not so much out of love for it, but really I just got it.
Sure. Right?
I would much rather play hockey or soccer or something.
Yeah.
But then I had one class, Mr. Lachlan in grade 11 physics class, who started telling us this stuff. And that was really the first time where I thought, wow, this guy is telling me that you can actually write some stuff on a piece of paper, do a calculation, and actually predict what's going to happen.
Right.
That's like, awesome. Why didn't anyone tell me about this?
Amazing.
That this thing was a thing, right? Yeah. I didn't even know, right? And that was really when it actually turned me on to it. And
sure.
And I just started like, you know, really getting a love for it. And then when I first went to university, I almost had it crushed out of me because it was first year especially was such a grind, and I had friends who were in other, you know, I had friends who were like doing literature and history, and they were learning about the falls of civilization and what actually happened in World War and all these like fantastic things that I didn't know about. And we were studying, here's a ramp, here's a block, calculate how fast it falls down the block, right? And then in second year, it's like, okay, now the block is moving, right?
Yeah, right.
And so they were very, very difficult. I found it very, very difficult because I also, my work ethic wasn't there, because in high school, everything just came so easily that the prof or the teacher would just say it, and I would say, oh, yeah, I got that. Makes sense. And then I came to university, and the baud rate in physics and math was so high. And I thought, holy shit, this is coming. So I didn't really like it, but I remember searching and flipping through the calendar and looking classes like quantum physics and general relativity, and I was like, that's cool stuff.
Yeah.
That's what I want to get to. So I kind of got this mentality that, okay, I have to like trawl through the desert and through the jungle to get to the other side. But I left after second year. I fell in love. We decided to like get out of Dodge, and we moved. We wanted to just get away from Ontario and go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of picked Dal by, we picked Halifax.
Right.
And picked Dal by, I think it was, we wanted to go to the coast. There was either Dal or UBC. Dal gave me like more transfer credits, and I kind of knew Halifax less. So we ended up coming here, and we had no money at all. And like literally no money at all. And so, and we didn't know anybody, so I had to study.
Yeah.
And so I actually got pretty good at that, right? And then the work ethic actually got up, and I learned advanced mathematics and the cool physics classes, and that was really when it actually hooked.
So you moved to, you said you moved to Halifax for love. Did that stick?
Now we're married and we have
three
children and
we're living in
the middle of the woods.
That's a hard question to ask, but I'm glad I did. I feel heartwarmed now. That's amazing. You've been a prof at Dal for
15 years,
but now you're really taking a tack towards commercializing some of the research
you've
done.
It was just following my nose and being curious and seeing where it leads to, and then I just all of a sudden have a company now.
Yeah, cool.
And it started off doing a particular line of research. So my background is in quantum computing.
Yeah.
I started doing research on quantum computing. I got a industrial contract to study quantum computing. But as we got more and more into it, I started asking the question, is why is this company funding this research? And then I started understanding more of the engineering problems they were having.
Mm-hmm.
And once I started understanding the technical problem they're having and the business problem they're having, they thought they had a computational problem. So they heard about quantum computing is this new kind of freaky thing that's going to take over the world. So they said, well, let's just fund some research into it because it seems like it's going to be important.
Yeah.
But what I realized after digging into the underlying reasons is that really they didn't have a computational problem. It was more of a organizational problem, how they phrased the questions and how they actually organized the problem that was the issue. And my background in physics, particularly in condensed matter physics, helped me inform how to approach the problem.
Would you say your perspective on quantum computing, if you think of it analogous to, say, regular computers, mm-hmm. I don't know what we call those, electron computers.
Classical computers.
What stage are we at with quantum computing? We as in the collective humanity. Is it like, the computer the size of a football field to solve a simple equation? Or are we at like the Apple IIe is going to come out next 10 years?
It's more like the early like 50s style, very very early stages. Even before then, still really trying to build up, trying to understand what it can do,
mm-hmm.
because the science is new and the engineering is also new. And so my thinking on this has evolved over the years. So I think a better way to think of quantum computing is analogous to lasers, right? So mm-hmm. we had light bulbs, and then this laser came along, and what was it? Well, this is just light, right? But we didn't end up using lasers to have better light bulbs or a source of ambient light.
Sure. Right?
But it was still light.
Yeah.
We ended up finding uses that we didn't even imagine before. The fact that laser is light is almost, besides the point, has other properties that are very useful, right?
For all our listeners, it's coherent.
That's right.
That's what the our light bulb's not coherent. It's random.
It's coherent and unidirectional, right? It all goes in a certain direction.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it's actually a pretty crappy light bulb.
Yeah.
Terrible light bulb. So I think what's going to happen with quantum computing is this whole quantum technology, we're going to have uses for it that we never even thought would be traditionally computing. Like cryptography is kind of one.
Right.
Sensors is another one.
Yeah.
Secure communications is another one. Those are the ones that we know now. There's going to be more
the ideas,
coming through that it's going to be unrecognizable.
Okay.
So David got a little bit of Jordan's personal story covered, and now we'll switch over to Shauna, who will ask him about the science in his life.
Tell me a little bit about the difference between theoretical physics and experimental physics.
The difference is that an experimentalist is in the lab with apparatus, with like gadgets and whizdongs and levers and needles and all this. You know, they're basically doing experiments.
For sure.
They're actually doing measurements, right? Whereas a theorist is trying to make sense of all that experiments, or put it into a coherent structure, right? Physics is an experimental science. Little bits of it are like bricks, right? But just doing data and just doing experiments itself is not actually a science any more than a pile of bricks is a house, right? So if you really want to make a science, you have to organize the bricks in order to make a house and understand how all the pieces come together. Also, you want to make predictions, right? So in physics, it has this big historical thrust of you have to actually make predictions about the future and the behavior, and that's how you actually can make progress. But because it became so specialized and so developed, it turns out that doing experiments is really, really difficult, and you need to devote your full time to actually get it right. And to do theory, you also have to, is also very difficult to really understand all the mathematics and put all these concepts together, that they kind of ended up being somehow separated.
Divided.
Yeah. There are a few people who
do both.
Yep. But it's very rare in physics. And I think the trend in science is more towards the physics way of doing things.
Okay.
As a science becoming more complex and more intricate.
Okay. Does one usually come before the other? Do the ideas need to be made and then someone has to do the experiment? Or does it go back and forth?
Most of the time, it's experiment comes first.
Oh, okay.
And you get some experimental result, and people think, what the hell is that? Experimentalist must be an idiot. You're totally wrong.
Yeah.
And then someone else does an experiment. And then more people do it. And they say, okay, well, maybe there's something here. Maybe there's something missing. And then the theorists get in and start concocting all kinds of crazy ideas. And they do more experiments, and one of them ends up being right. That's traditionally how it happens, but not always. Sometimes, rarely, the Higgs boson is an example. A theorist comes, looks at all its experimental results. They try to create some theory, and they say, well, this theory could be true, but it requires the existence of this other particle in order to make it work. And we haven't seen this particle. I don't know if it exists. And so you, experimentalists, why don't you go measure, see if this particle exists? And they'll do the experiment, and it actually it exists. I think my own personal leaning is that for physics to make progress, it has to have an empirical basis. So it has to, you need experiments, because every time theorists get together on their own and try to actually create something, 99% of the time they head off for open water, never to be seen from again. That happens over and over again. Not always, but sometimes.
So you've got the ideas, but then you need to do the experiments to confirm or deny the idea. But tell me a little bit about the research you did and what your focus was when you were a new prof at Dell.
Sure. My research was ostensibly on quantum computing. And more particular, it was about how can we observe quantum, like what can we do to be able to see quantum phenomena on a very large scale. Quantum is a branch of physics that governs the behavior of matter and energy at very, very small scales, or at a very, very fundamental scales. So we have a table. A table is made up out of molecules. Molecules are made up out of atoms. Atoms are made up out of electrons, protons, and neutrons. Protons and neutrons are made out of quarks, and so on. And as you get lower and lower scale, we start seeing behavior of matter that is very different than what we see in everyday life. And it's very counterintuitive. So things like what is a particle and what is a wave gets fuzzy. There's things in between there. And so quantum mechanics, quantum physics, is the branch of physics that describes what we think the behavior of matter is at a very, very fundamental and small scale, the building blocks of our world. So classical, let's talk maybe with classical computing, and we can put quantum computing in context as being in opposition or contradiction to classical computing.
Okay.
So if you look at now the classical computing, our general structure now, it's called a von Neumann machine. It was designed by mathematicians and physicists in like the 40s or so. And it's a digital computer, and everything is a zero or one.
Right.
And you have operations, like an AND gate, that has zero or ones coming in, and you have rules. They come into this box, and this rule says, okay, if both are one, output one, otherwise output zero.
Okay.
That's called an AND gate. Okay. And you have another one called an OR gate, that if either one of these inputs is a one, or either one of these is the one, then output a one, otherwise output a zero. So you can imagine all these little building blocks where you have two bits coming in that are either zero or one, and one bit coming out. And if you build enough of these together, you can show they can build an adder to multiply two numbers. And you can also build a web browser. And you can also build a piece of software. That's all you need to actually build a digital computer. All built out of zeros and ones and these Boolean logic gates. That's not the only way to build a computer, but that's the way our computers are built. A quantum computer, so all that is built on, is consistent with the laws of classical physics, the Newtonian mechanics,
right?
Our everyday world. Now, if you look at quantum mechanics tells you that things don't have to be in one or the other state. You can have combinations of states. So a state could be not just zero or one, it could be some combination. It could be like 60% zero and 40% one, right? And you can have these superposition of states, almost like water waves, how they can actually, you know, they can actually interfere constructively or destructively. Individual particles or elements of information, zeros and ones, can do that as well. So if you build these logic gates, like these ands and ors, not out of Boolean algebra, but of quantum Boolean algebra, now you have these quantum gates. So you still define these boxes, you still define qubits coming in, quantum bits coming in, quantum bits coming out, but the operation, the things you can do, are now, is a much wider space.
Okay.
So think of all the possible space of computing. Classical computing is one small corner of it. Quantum computing encompasses that, but it gives you a lot more. A lot of people know that the rules of quantum mechanics are very weird, they're very odd, they're very counterintuitive, and that's part of the thing that attracted me to the field in the first place. But then it's, yeah, but we can't see them. It's like tucked away inside an atom. And so a lot of it was, you know, why is it, why don't we see quantum phenomena on an everyday scale? And what can we do to try to exhibit quantum phenomena on an everyday scale? It was a natural fit to tie that with quantum computing because, one, it has an application. And two, the biggest, well, I'm not sure, one of the big problems in quantum computing is how to preserve the quantumness of your computer, right? And generally, this is a process called decoherence, which is what makes the quantum behave more classically, like the everyday, right? So decoherence is, say, the difference between a laser and a light bulb that we were talking about before, right?
Yep.
So quantum is like a laser. The classical world is like a light bulb. But now imagine if you have a the problem is now if you start observing, start messing with this quantum stuff and try exposing it to many other forces and interactions with the environment, it loses its quantumness. And so you want to actually restrict the interaction with the environment. So you want to block it off and isolate it. But so, for example, the inside of an atom is a nice isolated environment. So lots of quantum behavior there, right? Tiny, tiny little things interact less than big, gigantic things, right? Like a building.
Right.
But for quantum computing, there is an additional complication in that you can't completely isolate it because you want to actually manipulate it, right? You want to do a calculation, so you have to actually input things in. You have to control it very carefully in time in order to do some very pre-described evolution. And then you want to read it out. So you have to interact with the outside world. But that's also what kills the quantumness. So that my research is all understanding how we can better do that.
So I'm assuming somewhere along the way, you wanted to start answering questions that applied to the real world. And that's where you got interested in industry? Or how did that transition happen for you?
Well, quantum physics is the real world. Yeah. So I think it is maybe in some senses more real.
Okay.
But I did get interested more in industry.
Right.
It wasn't really a conscious decision mm-hmm. until much later on when I realized that, oh.
You look back.
I'm actually doing industrial stuff now. You know, how did this happen? I just started asking a different set of questions that, you know, I got some information and then I started formulating questions and I started learning more and I started pivoting mm-hmm. slowly before I realized I was in a completely orthogonal, you know, completely orthogonal direction. We were doing quantum computing mm-hmm. and we were approached by a company that had an interest in quantum computing and they wanted to fund some research. I started talking to the engineers, not only the funding and the R&D or the PR departments of these companies, but actually the engineers who actually had the problem. And they were telling me the kinds of problem they would have. And one meeting in particular, a light bulb came on when he said, you know, we're building these systems. You know, software is infused through the systems, right down to the core, right? 20 years ago, they were mechanical systems. Now it's just a chip that we're programming. And we have all these different components, you know, hundreds, thousands of components. We send them all out to our suppliers to spec. They build it. They come back. They give us exactly what we spec'd out for them. They're correct. And then we start assembling them. And we get behavior in the system that we did not expect. We did not predict. We do not understand. And what's particularly frustrating to us is that there seems to have anomalous behavior, so errors, mm-hmm. that we cannot ascribe to a defect anywhere in the system. They don't belong to an individual component. They seem to belong somewhere to the way they're interacting, or the way they're talking to each other. And so we can't really say that the supplier screwed up because they built it.
They did what you told them to do.
Yeah, and actually they built the correct thing.
Yeah. Right?
And so when I heard that, I started reflecting back, you know, what I said before about quantum mechanics, and I have it's the interaction that destroys everything. And so then I realized that these engineers were building systems that were so complex that you're seeing a lot of this emergent behavior, mm-hmm. collective excitations, that for the past 60, 70 years in physics, we've been studying and we have ways of dealing with it and understanding it and predicting it. We have theories about them that these artificial systems are behaving in a similar way, have similar analogous phenomena, not similar phenomena. They're not physical. Well, they're physical systems, but they're not natural systems. But they're behaving in an analogous way. So then we started applying some tools to do that, and we started making a lot of progress in it. And we got to a stage where we said, okay, people must have solved this verification validation problem in the world. You know, I mean, they're building these expensive million-dollar systems, billions-dollar systems. And then we looked at what other companies are doing to solve this. It's called design verification, how to verify the implementation of your design matches the behavior you want, right? And what we found out is the algorithm that we built, that designed in our lab, just because, you know, we thought this was a reasonable thing to do, were very different than what other people were doing. But we were already like 90% as good as the best commercial available tooling was. And this is after only like, you know, a few years of actually working on it. And then we said, whoa, we actually got something here, right? I barely know what I'm doing. And my team barely knows what we're doing. Now, what if we actually, you know, did do something? And then we got to a stage where I said, okay, well, we need, for this to make progress, we need to get this in the hands of engineers. Mm-hmm. That means we need to build an actual software product with a GUI and for them to interact. That wasn't me. I can develop algorithms and create theories. And my friend, Dean Saltis, who ended up being my co-founder, he was experienced in building big servers. He worked at Microsoft for a while. He built big enterprise-grade software applications. And so the two of us together said, well, maybe we got something here. I don't know what to do, so maybe we should maybe start a company and see how that goes. And we did that. We got some more contracts, and now QRA is 5 years old.
And you are now the CEO of QRA.
Yeah, president and CEO of QRA, and my co-founder, Dean, is a CTO. Right?
So now what does your day look like?
Yeah, so the day-to-day, it looks different. But other parts actually are not so different. So I've had arguments with people in the past. So this, not everyone agrees with this, but I think they're wrong and I'm right.
Hey, you're the CEO,
I'm frequently wrong, but never in doubt. and so, you know, here are what I think are the parallels. So when you're running a company, you're creating something out of nothing, right? Much the general public thinks it's all about making money, but it's actually not about making money. It's about building something that doesn't exist, that serves a useful purpose, that you need money to be able to scale and actually hire people so you can pay people to actually do it, right? And so financing is one aspect of it, but you're really creating something. And what you're creating, you don't quite know, and you don't quite know, like, what you kind of have a vision of where you want to go, but you don't quite know how to get there. You don't quite know in the environment you're operating in. So what you're doing, you're just constantly saying, okay, let's try this. Oh, that didn't work. Don't do that anymore. Stop doing that, right? Let's try this. Oh, this works. Let's do more of that. You sit there at the top of the company, look at what's going on. And every time you see some kind of like, think of like a heat map. And every time a little red thing pops up, it's like, oh, something's wrong there. I got to see what's going on there and try to fix it. And doing research is very much like that, right? You're in the dark.
Trial and error.
You kind of think what you're doing. You try something. It's like, well, that was a complete disaster. Let's not do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try doing this. And you know, generally you gain knowledge. And as you gain knowledge, you start, you know, having a better nose for the right questions to ask. Science itself is very scientific.
Yeah.
But I think the act of doing science is almost like a craft or a kind of artistry, because to ask the right questions is an act of creation. You're
mm-hmm.
creating something and you're trying to figure out something. And I think running a company is very similar. So the skills that I learned over 15 years of being a prof and trying to figure out, you know, how you're going to do what you're doing is really very useful in running a company.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about the future of your area of science right now.
Do you mean about the kind of science and engineering we're doing now at the company?
At the company.
Yeah, so we are now at the forefront, really, of a whole new age. I really, really...
This is a new frontier.
It's a new frontier.
We're just getting started.
And we're only just getting started.
Okay.
It's definitely not just our company. It's as engineering and science, it's
mm-hmm.
a whole new thing. And what's new about it is this idea of software eating the world, that everything we're building now is controlled by software. So this trend of automation is increasing. Right now, modern aircraft have about 85% of their systems are controlled by software, whereas 20 years ago, it was half that. 20 years before that, it was half that again.
Right.
So as that happens, that it means that the behavior of these systems is becoming less and less predictable,
mm-hmm.
right? And so how do we know that what we're building is the right thing to build? It's getting much more difficult to verify that before you actually build a prototype, right? And so now, if you go think in the future now, where you're going to have power stations that are manned by only one or two people, right? That 90% of its functions are going to be unmanned and automated. All our critical infrastructure is not going to be controlled by humans. It's going to be controlled by machines and by mm-hmm. algorithms, right? So that's very troubling. That's very worrying. But I think it's also a trend that we see coming. And the question is not whether it's going to happen or not. I mean, that's a question you can talk about. We can talk also about whether it's a good thing or not a good thing. That's another thing we can talk about. But I think one thing that's clear, that this is happening. So how do we prepare for that? And this whole thing of machine learning and data and these evolving algorithms, we need to figure out a way to make sure that when we build these systems, they do only the things that they're supposed to do and do not do the things they're not supposed to do. So how do we even define that is actually difficult. And after you define that, how do you actually ensure that is also very difficult, right? And so I think this is only at the very earliest stages, a whole new field of engineering.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. We'll let you get back to your day. We've taken up enough of your time.
Thank you very much. Yeah, had great fun, and thanks for inviting me on.